community.
Being among others.
A representation of our expanded strength.
Yeah. Identity crisis.
And inability to be exterminated.
Being brave and being stronger together.
Being together.
Being stuck between two identities.
Pride and bravery.
Stuart Hall's books.
Family and...
I don't know.
Hi everyone, this is Diaspora Diaries. I'm your host Awa and I'm here with Marianne to speak about navigating positionalities. To begin with, let me introduce myself. I am a black light-skinned woman. I'm Senegalese German. How about you, Marianne?
Hi, so I am a white woman and I'm French and German, but I grew up in France, if that's relevant. I feel like it might be.
It might be. I grew up in France too. So, what do you do? Who are you?
I study sociology in Canada at the University of Montreal. So, yeah, I would use the Indigenous name, but I do not know how to pronounce it, so I'm not gonna try.
Do you consider yourself as part of a diaspora?
No, I would not consider myself as part of a diaspora.
Why?
I think the question would be about me being half German in France or like now in Canada or whatever. But it's not like I'm part of any like cultural community. There's also like no aspect of like forced migration, which I think it feels like it's a big part of diasporas. Yeah, I feel like there's some sort of like imperialism in like implied in the concept of diasporas, and like it ties to like a homeland that are bound to like power dynamics, I would say.
I think that's Stuart Hall's definition of diaspora too, that there's the aspect of cultural identity and displacement that often the result of a forced displacement of different historical events such as slavery, colonization. And then I think there's also the perception of difference about like the extent to which you're perceived as a different person in that new place you're living in.
Yeah, or like even as like, for example, like second generation, third generation, because like, yeah, for me, like, I think that aspect of difference is also key. Like in France, even though I was sometimes like pointed at as like, oh, the German or whatever. But yeah, there's no concept of like a group that is identified by its difference, be it in terms of culture, a physical appearance, or you know.
I think like a very big part of diaspora is some kind of understanding of ethnicities, and I mean ethnicities in the very plural way in which ethnicities can develop, not even be, but just like genuinely develop. How do you perceive yourself in regards to that? Say, do you feel a certain sense of belonging to France and Germany in terms of, like, the country?
Yeah, no. Well, see, that's the thing. I feel like diasporas have a sort of claim to a country, right? Like, they kind of, they link their identity to a country. No,
well, or
like
ethnicities. People.
Yeah, exactly. Like, more, yeah.
Not necessarily a country.
Like a
people.
Like an
group.
Identity.
Cultural identity, yeah.
Yeah. And I definitely don't have that. Well, I mean, no. And in terms of, like, nationalities and stuff, I don't... That's also probably part of, like, growing up, you know, in a bilingual, bicultural to some extent setting. Yeah, like, that resulted in me not feeling connected fully to any of those places and cultures. Like, I would not say I'm, like, fully French. You know, like, I see some French people and I'm like, yeah, no, I'm not like that. Like, I'm just not.
Yeah.
Like, in Germany, it's the same. More in Germany than in France. Like, I definitely feel like I'm not German because I mostly grew up in France. Or, like, actually just grew up in France.
Still, we were brought up by German parents, right? One German parent, respectively. Mm. So, how does that factor in for you? How did you experience having a German parent growing up?
I don't know. I don't, like, relate to nationalities that much, or, like, more, like, cultures. For example, I know that, you know, I always, like, during Christmas and stuff, like, for example, like, both my families have the same religious background. There was, like, no conflict between that, so, like, the cultures on that end were, like, similar. But then during Christmas and stuff, we would combine traditions from Germany and from France. So yeah, so like on the one hand, like I don't think I, like it made me probably like not patriotic or like not like nationalist or like, you know, close to like any country or anything. But that probably also impacted the fact that I moved around after like my high school, you know, like I immediately went to like study abroad. The first thing was in Germany because I was like, oh, let me improve my German and be closer to my family. So I guess it's not like about, you know, getting closer to like a culture or anything. But yeah, and since then I've lived in other places too, and like, and now I live in Canada. Like, I think like it just put me on an international path, and I think that may be impacted by the fact that I grew up bilingual and like bicultural in a sense.
We spoke about how you perceived yourself growing up, but do you feel like there's been a shift when you moved to Canada, which is like neither France nor Germany? I mean, you've lived in the US too before. So like when you were outside of Europe or outside of France and Germany, do you feel like this sense of being German and French came out more, or no difference?
I think it's actually funny because like when I was living in France when I was little and like growing up, I would always mention that I'm German. Like, you know, when people ask me like, where are you from, whatever, I would always say like, oh, I'm half German. And then when I moved to Germany, I made a point of like telling people I'm half French. Like I would always just specify one side. And then when I moved to the US, which was like the first time I moved outside of Europe, I immediately said I'm French and German. Like I put both together because I was like, I guess maybe because at that point I had also lived in Germany. So I was like, yeah, I feel like I do have like different aspects of like both countries like within me. So yeah, and then now in Canada it's just, I don't think I care anymore. I'm just like, well, I mean, I do care in terms of like my positionality within like the Canadian society and stuff. Like I know I'm definitely not from Canada, and like it definitely affects my experience, but it's also because of like the history of Canada and like the whole Canadian context and stuff. It's like weird to be an immigrant, like a chosen, like I chose to go there knowing that Canada is like a settler colonial state. Like it's a weird thing to be in that position.
How do you position yourself in all that?
I think it's something I hadn't realized when I first moved there, which is like a couple months ago, like, right? It's like 4 or 5 months ago. I didn't realize, because like when I moved to the US, like that was not part of my thought process. Like I don't think I ever realized that the US was like a settler colonial state. And that was like 3 years ago or like 4 years ago. And so like now in Canada, I think also like through my studies, like it's definitely a topic that we address. But when I moved to Canada, I don't think I had realized the extent of like what it means to be European in Canada. You know, I asked myself like, would I feel comfortable staying here knowing that I'm contributing to, you know, like people are asking for their land back, you know, like I'm literally contributing to the problem of like indigenous land that is still
owned by or controlled by.
Yeah, like controlled, owned. Yeah. And like, this is just a form of violence in itself, like existing on this land. Even though like in Canada, like that's also a thing, like in Canada, the political discourse around indigenous people and land and cultures and all of that is like very, from the outside, like from an outside perspective, you kind of think, oh, they're so progressive, like they recognize lands and they recognize peoples and stuff. But then you get there and it's just like, you realize how it's just not like that. Like recognizing without doing anything about it is also like part of trying to like assimilate instead of making systemic changes. And so, like, living there as, like, a European, I don't know if I feel, like, legitimate to be there.
How do you navigate that positionality in academia, in your research or in class?
That's another difficult one. Because, like, I decided on sociology. Like, I wasn't doing that before, right? Like, I was definitely not on that path. And, like, I was always interested in those kinds of discussions, but I never thought about, like, actually studying those topics, right? Like,
what were you doing before?
I was interested in AI governance. So, like, I was kind of, like, debating between actually doing coding and stuff and, like, working in AI, or, like, doing governance and, like, political sciences and stuff and, like, doing, like, AI governance. So, like, the sociology thing came up more during my gap year, where I did, like, internships, and I was, like, working on, like, inequalities and, like, different sorts of inequalities within different institutions and stuff. And I just realized how, like, these are topics that I'm actually interested in, and, like, I would actually want to study them more, especially, like, the questions of different systems of oppression and the way they just are all connected. And, like, for example, environmental oppression with racism and just all of these different aspects, and, like, the decolonial perspectives and all of that. So, like, coming back to your question, that's definitely something I struggle with, because, like, it's hard to know if I am the person to do, like, to study these kinds of things. Yeah, just trying to figure out if I should, and if I'm the person to, like, the best person to do that, or if there's other people who should be in that position more than me. And yeah, you know, just like all these things.
Why would you not fit? What exactly makes you think, oh, I'm actually not the person that should be studying that, or that should be, I don't know, at the forefront of the research,
mm-hmm.
if that's a thing?
Well, just, like, first of all, like, I'm very privileged. Well, I consider myself as, like, very privileged. Both in terms of, you know, I'm a white woman from Europe. I am, like, financially stable and stuff. Like, you know, I have a lot of privilege. I'm, like, studying abroad. I know many languages. I am, for a fact, like, privileged. And trying to study these systems of oppression that I'm not necessarily feeling myself, how do I justify that? Not just, like, not in terms of, like, oh, I need to come up with a plan to, like, explain to people what I'm, like, doing that. But, like, why would I do that? And it's just because I think it's important to work on these topics. But I don't want to be, obviously, like, I don't want to be someone talking about people and just, like, making research for them and, like, trying to prove things for them without, like, I don't want to be that, like, external person coming to study people and then figure out stuff for them and, like, you know. But then I actually recently had a class in that, and there was, like, this one text that I actually really liked. It was from Linda Alcuff. It's actually really old, which I was surprised by. It's, like, 1991. Like, sometimes I wonder, like, why are we still at this place? I'm just, like, confused as to, like, why these things existed so long ago and we're still at the exact same spot. Like, it feels like that. But, yeah, anyway, she was, like, talking about the reasons, like, she was talking about, like, talking for people and whether or not it is acceptable and in which circumstances. And, like, we all agree that it's not, like, we, you know, we don't want to be talking for people like we just described. But then she said it's also not an option to retreat completely from the conversation, because that would also reinforce the systems of dominance that are in place. Because if we don't challenge them, like, how are they supposed to ever change, you know?
And I think it's also, to a certain extent, go in with it. If you don't get involved, you let these systems be. You let these systems flourish. You let them live.
So that's the thing. And, like, I think that's kind of, like, when I first arrived to Canada and, like, in my studies program, I was kind of, like, struggling with that. And my option, my head was, like, yeah, I can't do that. Like, I need to retreat. Like, it's not my place to, like, be doing that research. But then, like, reading that text, I was like, I get it. It's like, I do understand that we also need to be talking about these things and we need to be in those spaces, but maybe I'm not part of, like, the we that needs to be in those spaces, right? So I still, like, struggle to, like, know, like, to what extent I need to be doing that research and, like, be visible and stuff, because, like, that's also part of academia, right? Like, when you want to be in academia, you always have to be visible and doing, like, more research and more publications and more stuff, you know? Like, it's just, like, the system needs you to be visible if you ever want to be in the system, right? So, yeah, that's kind of, like, difficult. And then she presents four things that you need to consider before choosing to contribute to the discourse or not, and, like, speak to for others. And the first one is, like, the impulse, or, like, the impetus that you have. Like, what's your, like, what's the reasoning behind it? Because some people, it's just to, like, make themselves look better and stuff, right? Like, it's just, especially in academia, I feel like, you know, a lot of people are just like, oh, I need to write stuff. Like, I need to make myself look good, make myself look like a good researcher and stuff. So that's definitely not what we're trying to do. And she says, like, oh, and I'm quoting, if one's immediate impulse is to teach rather than listen to a less privileged speaker, one should resist that impulse long enough to interrogate it carefully. And at the same time, we have to acknowledge that the very decision to, quotes, move over or retreat can only occur from a position of privilege. And then the second thing that she mentioned is, like, location and context. And she says, like, for example, especially the thing about positionality, right? Like, a lot of people will choose to present their positionality at the beginning or, like, within a text and say, like, oh, you know, like, this is a justification, or, like, this explains my perspective, which can be good, but only if it actually has an impact on, like, you questioning what this positionality means for the research, or, like, for the words you're producing, or, like, the discourse. Like, if this, like, critical thinking doesn't happen behind the positionality statement, then, like, the positionality statement is just useless. Like, what's the point of it?
It doesn't do anything. And it is supposed to do something. I think you're supposed to engage with it within the context of your research. It's not outside of your research. And I think a lot of scholars get that wrong. They would present their positionality as something that is aside of their research, that is not constitutive of their research, and I think that's the mistake a lot of people do.
So, like, that's the second one. Then she talks about responsibility. That's just the fact that when you're speaking, you should always, like, carry with yourself, like, a sort of accountability. Accepting criticism from people, especially the concerned group, like, the concerned community people that you're talking about or for or to. If you don't have this, like, reflective attitude about your own work, then you can't be speaking for or to or about people. Like, that's just, you know, that's when, like, there's an issue that arises.
And I think here I'd also add constantly questioning again and again and again, because I think what a lot of people would also tend to do is question it once, and if they get validation by often the people they want validation from, then they would be like, okay, I'm good. I don't need to question myself again.
Yeah.
Whereas I think seeking first criticism and feedback from a lot of different people and a lot of different groups, especially the groups involved in the research, is important. But I think there's also, on top of that, the aspect of time. I think throughout time, you also need to question your research again. There's always new things that you didn't see, or that the people you asked back then didn't see back then. So,
yeah, and I feel like, you know, that's also, for example, like, when doing, let's say, field research, there are a lot of people that will, like, ask for permission or, like, consent or whatever at the beginning of the research and then never ask again. And it's like, yeah, you got it from, like, people signed, but, like, ethically, is that, like, relevant? No, like,
because so many things changed.
Exactly.
Like, especially in field research, I don't know if you're doing, like, ethnographic research or if you're doing, like, interviews. Sometimes things just slip out.
Mm.
And so seeking that approval again after the research and after a few years, I'd argue, is just so important.
Yeah, definitely. And then the last one, which is actually her most important one, is the effects of the discourse. So, like, she says, for example, in order to evaluate attempts to speak for others in particular instances, we need to analyze the probable actual effects of the words on the discursive and material context. So we must also look at where the speech goes and what it does there. So, like, that was all part of her text. And I think, like, that's definitely, like, really important as well. And, like, for example, like, refusing to include things, or even for communities to, like, refuse to, like, talk about aspects of their cultures, their whatever. That's what Audra Simpson names ethnographic refusal. Just, like, forms of refusal, I think, are also important. But when you're trying to think about what the impact of, like, your research is, realizing that some of it might not need to be public, or, like, might not, you don't want to have that out there.
And it's very legitimate.
Definitely.
Do you want to expand a bit more on what you mean or what you understand under ethnographic refusal?
From what I understood, like, right now, I think it can be both on the part of, like, the researchers, but also, like, the communities and, like, the people and stuff, because, like, the researchers can choose to not include aspects of what they found out in their papers or, like, in, like, public information. Whereas, like, the communities, I think that's, like, probably, like, more the empowering aspect. Because, like, for the researcher, it's, like, I feel like it's more, like, an ethical thing, right? It's, like, I know that if I put that out there, it might harm the people that I'm talking about. But for the people that, like, the communities and stuff, when, especially if it's, like, an outsider researcher, or, like, maybe sometimes even if it's just, like, someone from their community, but, like, they know it's in the perspective of research, they can just choose not to divulge some information about themselves. Because it's, like, what do you mean I'm going to be, like, you know, they're going to put in text whatever I said and say this is, like, the reality of a whole group of people and stuff, like.
And I think that draws back to the imperus, the first element he mentioned. It reminded me of Ruben Anderson's research on clandestine migration, where the author discusses how people that had migrated and had been deported back to their country would speak about very specific things when researchers would come or journalists would come. What is the aim behind the research? What is the researcher trying to do? Why would the person that is being interviewed collaborate and help you further your research most of the time would not benefit from your research or from your interview in the case of, like, journalists? Why would they collaborate? And I think that's why it's also so important to think about your research and think about what you're trying to do with your research. Your research, I believe, should have a specific goal. And if this goal is not helping the people that are involved, then you should actually question your research.
It can also, like, divulging information about themselves. Like, obviously, through history, we know that the majority of researchers have portrayed them as others, right? So it's like, why would I want to contribute to something knowing that the outcome is going to be me equals outsider?
And that's why it's also so important to acknowledge that some people are not going to speak to you.
Yeah.
And some people are not going to say what you want to hear. Because again, if it doesn't further their interest in any way, why would they?
Yeah. And also, like, actually thinking back about, like, the question, you know, initially it's about, like, how I deal with that. I feel like recently I've also thought about methodologies and, like, methods that are more in line with what I'm trying to do. And for example, like, me being in that privileged position can actually help me raise voices that are not heard. And, like, I've seen some research that was done collaboratively where, at the end, the name of the author wasn't the name of the researcher, but the name of the people that were actually participating in the research. So it's just that you're using your platform and, like, your leverage as, like, a researcher to make other voices heard. And I think that's actually really nice. I've, like, read articles and stuff that were, like, based more on, like, testimonies. And even though the name of the researcher at the end was still the name of the primary author on the paper, like, it wasn't research as in interviewing people or like having participants and stuff. It was more like their perspective from the beginning to the end.
And I think here it's also very important to specify that we all have a positionality, because, like, we started with discussing diaspora, discussing how you fit in or do not fit in any diaspora, and you mentioned how you very much debated whether you belong where you are and whether you're the one that should do the studies you're interested in doing. But I think we also have to acknowledge that we all have a positionality, and most of the time in academia, if we are in such circles, we have some kinds of privileges. And all the things you've mentioned earlier about debating and questioning again, like, how you should conduct your research and if you should conduct your research, I think this is something I'm also thinking about a lot. Being a Black woman is not enough.
You know what that also reminds me of? I had, like, this tendency to think that people that are affected are, like, the best to, like, talk about themselves, which, when I say it like that, obviously it's true. But then if you think about it, you can't generalize people's situations. Like, as you said, like, we all have, like, very specific backgrounds, very specific, like, positionalities and stuff. And, like, it's not because, like, you're a Black woman, you can represent all Black women. Like, that's not, you know, that's not it. Or, like, I'm obviously not going to represent all, like, French people or German people, you know, or even more specific things. So I think, yeah, that's just, like, something I'm also trying to, you know, like, it's just something, it's also not just black or white. It's, like, more complex than we think. And, like, I think especially within research and, like, recently with all this, like, you know, acknowledging that the people affected are the ones who should be talking, we also need to be careful that it's not just, like, a couple of representatives that take all the voice and, like, speak for everyone else, because that would just be reproducing the same mistakes as we've been doing, like, for years and years and years. So
I think that's a great way to conclude. It very much highlights how we live in a very complex world.
Yeah.
Identities are very complex, existences are very complex, and I think it's important to think about how we navigate them. What do you think? Do you agree? Do you have different perspectives? We are very happy to hear more about your opinions, so feel free to let us know. Thank you so much, Marianne, for this conversation.
Thanks for inviting me.